Working Class Audio is brought to you by Roswell Pro Audio, GearSluts.com, The License Lab, Audio Technica, and Universal Audio.
This is the Working Class Audio Podcast, session 184.
Working Class Audio, navigating the world of recording with a working class perspective. Here's your host, Matt Boudreau.
Thanks, Chuck. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Working Class Audio Podcast. This is session 184 you're listening to. My guest today is Joe Tissone, who is the owner and the lead audio engineer at Mystery Street Recording Company in Chicago, Illinois. Joe is running an incredible operation there in Chicago. It is the epitome of diversification of audio in every respect. And we talk about diversification a lot on Working Class Audio, and Joe is really doing a great job with it. He's got a team of about five people, six people, including himself, obviously. And they're doing everything from audio restoration, mastering. They've got a studio. They deal with all kinds of different forms of audio, as well as a rehearsal studio. So check it out. It's at mysterystreetrecording.com. I rant about it endlessly in the interview. But yeah, Joe Tissone coming up here on the Working Class Audio Podcast. Summertime's here, and being that I'm kind of a glasses half full kind of guy, or as my oldest son has said to me before, that people don't always consider that the glass is refillable and you can fill it to the top. I thought that was good. Anyhow, I'm always looking for, you know, whether it's a New Year's resolution or summertime or some kind of moment in time where you can kind of push the restart button, reboot, kind of get things together. So I always look at summertime as the time when I do my purges of stuff, get rid of stuff I'm not using. It's also the time I get a lot of my documents together, digitizing all that stuff. I've talked about that before. But it's also a time, you know, if you've had kind of a rough year and you're kind of like, oh man, these first 6 months of the year have not been the best. Never fear, summertime is here, and you can kind of reset and retool. So look at it as an opportunity to, take a good inventory of what you're doing, how you're getting work. We talk about word of mouth. We talk about how important that is. We talk about getting out. If you're stuck at home and you're just doing nothing but Facebooking all day, get your ass out of the chair and away from the computer and go and see some bands, go meet some clients, some potential gaming clients or location sound people. Get out and network. Go do it. I know that when you get to a point where it's just the phone isn't ringing and you're financially not in the best position, getting a lot of motivation to get out can be a challenge. So I'm here to tell you, you can do it. And maybe you're working a day job you're not digging. Maybe you're driving a van and doing some deliveries. I know a lot of you who listen to the show do that. And you can't see through to the other side. You can do it. Believe me, the light is at the end of the tunnel. You just have to focus on what it is you want to do, right? Don't be afraid of it. All right, that's my rant for the day. Go make some work happen. So I was talking to our friends over at Universal Audio the other day, and they said, hey, make sure your listeners know about this. We're doing a half yearly sale, and I've got a link. I'll put it in the show notes. They're doing up to 60% off. That's pretty good on the plugins here. Fender, Empirical Labs, Lexicon, Manly, API, Neve. There's a lot more. Let me see. Let me give you an example. Okay, so normally the Fairchild Tube Limiter Collection, that's normally $299. That's $99. Yeah, the Teletronics LE-2A collection, normally $300. That's $99. Also, the 1176 Classic Limiter collection, normally $299, $149. So I'll put a link. I've got some pretty clever videos to go along with this to promote it. But check out these deals. This is good. There's a lot of good deals here. You can get the AKG BX20 Spring Reverb. It's normally $200. You can get it for $99. Anyhow, lots of cool stuff to be had there. I'll put a link in the show notes, so check that out. And remember, We're sponsoring the Gear Slut sub forum called Audio Life. So head on over there and check that out. That's, of course, discussions that are very much the same as they are here on Working Class Audio. It's just in a forum. So good companion, I always say. I think the two fit together really well. Anyways, that's at gearsluts.com. Well, I tell you, we could just sit here and listen to this music, couldn't we? That's some pretty trippy music. Let's get some coffee and listen to this music until it runs out. No, let's get to it, actually. Let's get over to our conversation with Joe Tissone here on the Working Class Audio Podcast. Well, hey, man, welcome to the podcast. Thanks for coming on and taking the time to do so at such a late hour. It's going to be an interesting conversation. I am super fascinated by Mystery Street Recording Company and what you got going on there.
Thank you.
Let's start with you. Let's go back to where it all began. Mm-hmm. Give me kind of the encapsulated history of how we got to this point where you have this fantastic facility.
Sure. I guess going back to the early days, I was about 14 years old and playing in a punk band. I bought a PA system. I was a singer in a punk band and we needed to amplify. So I bought a PA and started doing live sound for my friends' bands, doing house shows, garage shows, that type of thing. And I didn't have a car at the time. I'd just haul around a PA system in a red wagon, charge my friends $25 a show, and would slowly build my gear equipment up, just getting microphones and getting a bigger and bigger live sound rig. By the time I was about 17 or 18, I bought my first Pro Tool system. And I'm just getting like a Digi 002. And I started doing some live recording. With that, started building a little bit of a clientele. You know, I'd record some bands live and think, oh, can you do something in studio with me too? So I was just doing home recordings and that developed into a larger home studio and realized, oh, yeah, I kind of like doing this. People like what I'm doing. I'm going to take this a little bit further. And I went to Columbia College and, you know, really to learn the details of what I was doing. Up until that point, I was just self-taught, trying to figure it all out on my own. And I met my former business partner there. He was a classmate of mine. And he and I opened Mystery Street. In my last semester at Columbia, I actually took an internship with the Old Town School of Folk Music. While I was there, I met the person who I started renting my studio space from. And he was running band rehearsal spaces out of our studio. He was looking to have some rented out, wanted to get out of the business a little bit. And it was just, I was in the right place at the right time to get this space. And it's just a really great facility, a lot of history here. So, you know, we just worked out well. My internship was actually with, at Old Town, was doing audio archiving and audio preservation. They've recorded almost every live performance they've ever had there since 1955. And they put on, at least a show a week, if not almost every day. So tons and tons of audio. And this was about 11 years ago now. They were one of the first people to really take a collection of that size and try to release some of the audio. At this point, I can't even count how many different songs we've archived, but you know, over 50,000, I'm sure. And so it's a huge, huge archive of roots and folk music. And so there's some really, really cool stuff in there. Live recordings, plus like field recordings, home recordings from people. So I was interning there. I basically wrote this protocol for them of like, here's how you archive audio. And by the end of it, my boss there was like, well, I can't teach this to anybody else. So do you want a job? It's like, yeah, sure do. You know, I was just graduating college. So got a job there, just 15 hours a week or so. And but at the same time, I decided to open the studio with my classmate. So I was doing both things simultaneously. The studio was growing in its own way. You know, I was doing the archiving on the side, but slowly the two merged and I started moving all of the archiving into Mystery Street and out to where that is now here today.
Wow. Let's go back to the red wagon.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So you have or had at that time a sense of an entrepreneurial spirit that, I mean, a red wagon and a PA system and a punk band. So tell me about those entrepreneurial leanings, and where did that inspiration to just, you know, oh, I don't have a car, I'll get a wagon. Where did that come from? Did your parents have a large role in that?
My grandfather owned a restaurant. My dad owned a restaurant. My brother opened a restaurant. And I was around businesses a lot. You know, none of them were, you know, wildly successful or large, and just really small businesses. It was just sort of, you know, I was always around that idea. And you know, I grew up in, you know, a small town. We didn't have a lot of money, and you know, it's like if I wanted to, you know, do something with my life, I kind of had to do it myself. And that's really where a lot of that came into, is just kind of that DIY punk rock spirit, going, hey, I want my band to be heard. I need a PA system. So here's what I'm going to do that. And I need more gear to be able to do this and that. And that's really what it came down to, is really more of a, out of necessity more than out of like, I want to, you know, build a business. It was, I need to do this. And so that seems to be the ongoing trend here. And, you know, as we grow the company, a lot of the services that we add on or the equipment we buy really come out of necessity. Someone comes to us and says, hey, we need this done. Can you do it? It's like, well, I know how to do it. And if I had the equipment to do it, yeah, I can. So I'll go out and get what I need. So it's sort of grown organically like that.
Let me ask you something about that equation. I come to you, I have a job I want done. You have the knowledge, but it requires you to make an investment. Mm-hmm. So what if the job doesn't even cover the cost of the investment? What's your decision at that point?
I look at it as a long-term thing. So if I can at least cover a portion of the cost of the equipment with the job, the next time around, maybe the equipment's paid off. Maybe, you know, three times down the road, it'll be paid off. But once I have the equipment, now I can say to the, you know, say to the world, we can do this. And now advertising with it, we can bring more of that business in too.
You wait for somebody to ask for the service. Is that correct?
Yeah, in a lot of ways. So I'm, rather than spend a bunch of money, get into a lot of debt, and try to figure out how I'm going to pay for it all, I typically wait for something to come along that's going to help me pay for it.
Okay, so I just have this lasting image of you walking down the street with this red wagon and this PA system, with maybe with a mohawk, maybe not.
Oh, yep, it was blue mohawk.
Mm-hmm. Blue mohawk going down the street. So at Columbia, you went to Columbia. Mm-hmm. What did you study there?
Audio design and production. So, you know, learning voiceover, learning music production, hearing science, those types of things. You know, really, that just helped me to get more detail about the things I already knew. It's like I was doing a lot of these things, but I didn't know why I was doing them. And Columbia gave me that background on that, but also gave me a lot of the connections that I needed in order to really succeed in the industry. Knowing mm-hmm. people that I could rely on when I had a question, just building a network up. I didn't really know anyone who did this until I went there.
Did you have any business classes there? Any classes that would arm you or better prepare you for going into business
no.
at the scale that it seems you're at?
No, I've never taken a single business class. And that I always just learned on my own. I don't feel like I'm a business person. I'm an audio engineer with the, you know, the spirit to you know, feed my family, you know? So, you know, I've got a lot of drive, and that's really what pushes me more than, you know, just looking at numbers.
Yeah. So how did you come up with the concept of Mystery Street?
So we started the company with a business partner. He and I both had home studios, and, you know, got to the point where we're bringing a lot of strangers into our homes and started to get maybe a little bit uncomfortable to continue doing that. But he and I both had a fair amount of equipment. And when we were in class together, we would share equipment for projects and things like that. And once we both graduated, we're like, hey, let's just put all of our stuff together and, you know, start a space and see how it goes. You know, that's really all it was. You know, it wasn't some, you know, some grand thing. You know, we were a small studio when we first opened, and we're planning to just, hey, we're going to be a music production studio. This is what we are. And immediately the rehearsal spaces came in, because the space was actually a rehearsal space of the previous about 10 or so years. And so we took over the space, and the bands are calling us up and going, we want to rehearse in our room. What's going on? Like, can we rehearse there? And we didn't have a huge client base yet. So we're like, yeah, yep. You can do that. Come on in. And so we'd set the rooms up with, you know, my PA system that I had from when I was 14 years old and, you know, our band's guitar amps and drums and just let people jam on them for $10 an hour. And that helped us to pay the bills at first. And that built up to something else.
Yeah. And I think what I'm just so impressed by and somewhat overwhelmed by is just the sheer amount of services. You're really taking advantage of, it's not like, hey, we're recording engineers. We just want to work on recording bands. You are tapping into all the different elements. You're diversifying, which we talk a lot about on Working Class Audio is, you know, diversifying to really bring in these different income streams and all these different things, especially the hourly rehearsal spaces. I just think it's brilliant.
Thank you. Like I said, a lot of it just comes out of necessity. You know, when we add a new service onto what we're doing is because someone's asking us to do it. They're going, hey, we want to work with you. We like you. We like what we've done with you before, this other project. Can you do this for us too? And like, yeah, let's do it. I get that all the time. We have a lot of crossover. I had somebody call up. We transferred some old records for them a couple of years ago. The guy's a real estate agent and he called me up today and goes, I'm looking to start a podcast. And I remembered I did these record transfers with you a few years ago and I had a great experience. I'd like to talk to you about this. So we get a lot of crossover like that. Even like with the karaoke parties, you know, that's like kind of a silly thing that we do that came up from someone who's like, hey, my kid's really into music and I want them to come into a studio and do something. And so we just came up with this concept to, you know, for one person. And then all of a sudden every kid in that party is like, I want to do this. I want to go. Oh, yeah. I want to be in a recording studio too. This was awesome. And then it like became, you know, something that we offer. You know, we've been doing those now for 11 years and we get people who come back now who had their 10th birthday party here and now they're 20 years old and they've got a band or, you know, they're a rapper and they're like, you know, I had an awesome time here. So it's like part of that is like teaching the younger generation that you can come into a studio and get a good recording and you don't have to have a record deal. And that was something that I didn't know about when I was a 14-year-old funk with a red wagon. I thought that, you know, hey, if I want to get a good recording for my band, I need to like show off. I need to do this thing, like have this like big, huge stage presence so I can, you know, get signed to one of these record labels so I can get into a real studio, not just somebody's basement. And I didn't realize until later that you can just go into a studio. And I think there's just this misconception about that. Just in general, in the general public, that studios are for superstars. And it doesn't have to be that way. Part of what we do in Mystery Street is offer a space that's welcoming and open to all people, you know, regardless of, you know, if you're just starting out or you're a pro. And, you know, it's been successful for us.
That's interesting. So, you know, you have everybody from kids doing karaoke birthday parties to pros making records. What is the general approach? You know, is there like a mission statement to make everybody feel welcome? And like when new people come to work there and work for you, what do you tell them?
We have a mission statement. I'd love to read it to you if you can give me a moment. I'll
please,
pull it up.
Yeah.
You know, it's, you know, that's actually pretty important to what we do here. It reads like this. Mystery Street Recording Company is more than just a business, it's a community. Our values are reflected in all that we do. We strive to provide a safe and welcoming environment for all people. We will not judge each other, and we will not turn a blind eye to oppression or injustice. We will be a part of the greater community through participation and outreach, help our industry grow by working together and offering our talents and resources to other engineers, producers, musicians, venues, labels, and record stores alike, create to the best of our abilities, and we will hold ourselves and each other accountable for maintaining high standards in our work and stand out by being on the cutting edge of service and professionalism in our industry.
Wow. Well, that pretty much says it all as far as how I was imagining this situation to where you have these different groups of people from different backgrounds coming together and passing each other in the halls. Mm-hmm. When you have, let's say you have clients that uh, their lifestyle and their habits may be a little bit out of step with, say, a younger crowd coming in for a birthday party. How do you make that work?
You know, the people that come in here are all just really cool. You know, I mean, like, everyone gets it, and we're all kind of here for the same reason. You know, everyone is here because they really enjoy making music. You know, at the core of it, you know, music production is what we do, and we have a lot of other things that we do, but music production is really what it comes down to. And, you know, when someone sees a kid's birthday party, a lot of times, you know, someone in that band has their own kids and they're going, hey, that's awesome that you're allowing kids into your space. You know, a lot of studios are more like doctor's offices where it's like, don't touch anything. It's like, if a kid wants to bang on some drums, cool. Like, that's what I was doing when I was, you know, 14. I didn't know how to play a guitar properly. I'm just hitting it, you know? It's like, I can play, you know, two chords poorly. And, you know, so I always wanted to create a space that was inviting and, you know, welcoming to people like that. You got to start somewhere. But you know, for the people that are seasoned, you know, it's like we've got what they need too. So across the board, you know, we can set people up with, you know, long sessions and huge productions, or we can keep it really simple and, yeah, just kind of fun for people.
I'm counting only six people on your team there. Mm-hmm. Are there more?
You know, we have freelancers that we work with every now and then, but primarily it's just, you know, it's the core of us. And, you know, and we'll have interns every now and then. We do an internship program through Columbia, and we mostly hire through our internship program. We tend not to hire just people who apply for jobs. We like to get to know how people work. So whether they are, they take an internship with us or they are freelancing out of our studio, I mean, we want to get to know who we're working with and make sure that their values are in line with what we really are looking for as a company.
Are you overwhelmed at this point with the amount of work coming in there and versus how much staff you have?
You know, that's always a thing. I mean, there's an ebb and flow to it. So like some weeks it's slower than others. Some weeks we're like, oh my God, how are we going to get all of this done with people's deadlines? So sometimes it just means working overtime that week, and next week, well, I got a couple extra days off, and it shifts around like that. Especially with the archival projects that we do, you know, where someone, hey, we've got, you know, 500 open reel tapes that we need transferred, you know, this month, and now suddenly we've got to add, you know, 500 hours of labor, you know, in that month to get this done in someone's deadline. We can't always accomplish that with our general staff. So sometimes we'll reach out to other, you know, freelance engineers and contract engineers who we've worked with and have them come in and step in on a project.
How many square feet do you have there?
We have about 4,000 square feet.
Okay. That's good. I was going to say, because this is a lot of different, things that you do.
But our space is really versatile too. So, you know, when our rehearsal rooms are also our studio rooms. So, you know, weeknights when, you know, bands are in here having band practice, we're doing mix sessions and we're doing other things we've got to do. We're doing a mastering session where, you know, we don't need the live rooms during those times. Mm. So we use them for the rehearsal spaces. We try to just make the most use of every room. And we're doing parties. We clear the rooms out of, you know, drums and amps and throw up some tables so people can have cake and pizza. So they're versatile.
Hey, I want to give a shout out to our friends over at Audio Technica. They help make the Working Class Audio podcast possible. You can find them at audio-technica.com. They, of course, offer headphones, microphones, turntables, turntable cartridges, as well as many accessories that you might need, like headphone replacement cables and headphone pads. The great thing is there's no hesitation required. If you see something you like, you can buy it right there on the website. So check them out, audio-technica.com. And thanks for supporting our friends at AT. What have been the biggest challenges in the time that you've been running Mystery Street?
So many challenges. Okay, well, you know, I got a laundry list there. So we had a fire. That was one thing. 8 months after we opened, we had a fire in our control room and lost all of our equipment. That was pretty devastating. Luckily, we had insurance. This is one of those situations where I was able to fall back on someone who I met at Columbia, one of my old professors, Dan Dietrich. He was a awesome professor, and he ran a studio in town called Wall to Wall. You know, after the fire, you know, he helped us get back up and running. He helped us, you know, redesign our control room. You know, bought most of our gear from him. You know, he wired everything else up for us and just really helped us get back on our feet. But in the meantime, because we wanted to continue to work with our clients, he offered up one of his studios to us to work out of at no cost through the time we were, you know, remodeling and trying to get back up on our feet. So it was just like this community thing that was just like really huge for us. And, you know, we like to carry that on. Like, that was awesome that he was able to do that.
What was the cause of the fire?
There was a lamp that was plugged into an extension cord. The cord was somehow made its way underneath the leg of a couch, caused a short, caused some heat to build up and caught the couch on fire. So we had all this,
wow.
Yeah, we had all this gear in the room, and it wasn't any of that. It was just a, you know, $15 lamp. So.
Was it mostly smoke?
Yeah, a lot of smoke, a lot of heat. We were actually hauling a piano to the studio while that was happening. I had a friend meeting us here to help us load it in, and we were about a block away in a U-Haul truck. And he calls me up and he goes, "Hey, Joe, just so you know, the police are blocking off your street. So maybe go around the back to the alley. I'm not really sure what's going on." I'm like, "Okay, cool." And then I get off the phone with him, and 30 seconds later, he calls me back. He's like, "They just busted your door in. You know, you got to get over here right away." So, you know, and like smoke's, you know, flying out of the building. So I get out of the truck and I just, you know, run like I've never ran before over to the studio. And, you know, it's like, I talk to the firefighters. I'm like, "Hey, this is my place. Like, what's going on?" And they're like, "You know, what's the most important thing to you in that first room there?" I was like, you know, just thinking fast. I'm like, "I've got hard drives. Like, where are they?" You know, sitting on the desk. So they go in, they pull our three hard drives off of our computer desk, bring them outside to us. And then two more firefighters drag a burning couch out of the building, hose it down outside while others go in. They cover all of our gear with tarps before they bring a hose even into the building. They're like, "We're just trying to protect your equipment the best we can." And they end up only putting down like a gallon of water to put the whole fire out. But everything was destroyed because of the heat and the smoke, and everything in the entire building had to be refinished. And, you know, I smelled like a barbecue pit for 3 months.
What did you lose in there?
Yeah, there was a lot of stuff. I mean, there was tape machines. You know, the thing is, like, it was a lot of our home studio gear at the same time. So it was a lot of kind of prosumer stuff that wasn't all that great yet. So we were able to trade in, you know, four crappy reverbs for, you know, one good one. And we were able to just get better equipment when all was said and done. One of the things that was really cool, and this is, again, another example of like the audio community coming together, was we had a dual 1176. It was messed up, and we called Universal Audio and we told them the story, and they're like, "Oh, well, you know, we've never had one that was on fire. You know, if you want to send it to us, like, we'll just send you a brand new one. We'd love to check it out." So they just replaced it at no cost to us. And it was just like really cool that they were willing to do that. You know, we had a pair of M1, John Hardy M1s, same thing. You know, we brought him over to John Hardy. He's, you know, just a north suburb here. We brought him up to him, and, you know, he fixed the thing up, added a couple new ones in for us. And, you know, it was really cool to see like everyone kind of going, "Hey, like, this really sucks that this happened to you. We're going to help you out and get you back on our feet." So when it was all done, it, you know, we turned out to be a much better studio because of it. But, you know, everyone's just like, "Oh, just, you know, cut your losses and leave now." You know, it's like, you know, you've been struggling for 8 months, and like, yeah, we've only been in, you know, haven't even been in business a year yet. How do we know what we can become? You know, I'm not going to just like take this small insurance check and say, "See you later" to my audio career. And so we reinvested, and, you know, we spent some more money at that point because we kind of saw it as an opportunity, and we ran with it, and, you know, ended up better because of it.
When it comes to something like a fire like that, what are the things that a lot of people don't think about or plan for?
Yeah, I keep an inventory. That was one of the things that, you know, was hard. Like, when they're like, "Tell us everything that you lost." And, well, when things are burned up, it's sometimes harder to do that. Yeah, but we were able to claim everything from, you know, the console to CDRs and CD sleeves and, you know, the you know, pens and paper. So like everything we had, we were able to make a claim on, and, you know, and to make sure we got a proper insurance check to replace everything. So, you know, at this point, you know, our systems manager here, Daniel, he keeps a running inventory of everything we have in the studio, just this huge document of, you know, every cable and connector and absolutely everything is inventoried here. You know, we update that, you know, as often as we can and try to, you know, re-inventory everything, you know, maybe once a year. But that's just something that's important to have. And so when you're, even when you're, you know, on a day-to-day basis, if you're looking for something, you can't seem to find it, you can look at an inventory sheet and go, wait, do we even own this? Or where is it? How many of these do we have? You know, let's order this and let's make that. So that's really important to plan for a worst case scenario. Having good insurance is important. It's not cheap, but it's important to do, especially if you're, you know, trying to operate a commercial studio. You know, I know a lot of studios that, you know, they're operating without a business license and they're operating, you know, with, you know, definitely without insurance. You're not going to get, you know, business liability insurance if you don't have a business license. And so it's just one of those things where, you know, we try to operate above the table all the time, just to make sure that, you know, for one, we're covered, and also our clients are safe. You know, I think that's helped us grow as well. It's easy to, you know, to kind of go, well, I'll take the $20 cash and, you know, shove it in my pocket and, you know, forget about it. But it's like, those are the types of things that actually end up holding you back in the long run. You know, when you need to get funding for something, it's like we were able to get loans to remodel our studio because we were able to show that we had income. If, you know, we're always doing everything under the table, you can't do that. You're always just going to be, you know, struggling to build. You're always going to kind of be at square one.
Mike Wells, mastering engineer, who's been on the show, really, he didn't coin this term, but he really brought it home in his episode where he just talked about short-term pain, long-term gain. You know, it may hurt to, you know, be above board on some levels financially, or, you know, from a logistical standpoint, a time investment standpoint, but long-term, it can really be in your favor.
It is hard to find insurance. It's hard to find funding, and because it's a risky business. And so you've got to just do everything you can to really just prove yourself that you can make this thing happen and function in order to grow.
Shout out to our friends over at Roswell Pro Audio, who helped make the Working Class Audio podcast possible. Recently had the pleasure of using their Mini K47 mic, which is priced at $299 on a Marshall cabinet. And I got to tell you, it sounded absolutely amazing. And that's going to be part of my setup from here on out. So if you want to check it out, go over to RoswellProAudio.com, and they do offer free shipping. But if you really want to help our cause with them, make sure on the checkout when you're buying a mic that you include the code WCAFREESHIP. And that way they know that you came from us and you heard about Roswell Pro Audio from Working Class Audio. So there it is. Check it out. RoswellProAudio.com.
After, you know, our fourth year in business, is when my business partner left. I had bought him out at that point, and then I was like totally broke again. And I put everything I had back into the studio to keep it operating. Right at the point where I had him paid off, the former landlord decided to put the building up for sale. And I had like no money for a down payment, nothing. I was like, well, I'm probably going to go out of business because I'm not going to be able to buy this place. This building is 130 something years old, and it's going to be demolished if anybody buys it. It's just guaranteed. That's what they do down this whole strip that I'm on here. We're, I think, the oldest wood frame building on our on Lincoln Avenue in Chicago, and it's a long street. We figured we'd just get pushed out, and there's nothing I can do about that. So I started asking around and saying, hey, you know, anyone want to join a recording studio? Like, you want to buy in? And wasn't finding anybody. I reached out to, again, another old Columbia professor of mine, Benj Cantors, and he's like, well, you know, now I don't know anyone who wants to do that, but I was going to contact you because Mike Santucci over at Sensophonics is looking for a sound engineer, you know, a consultant. And I, you know, immediately thought about you, and, you know, I was going to call you, but I've been busy with, you know, the end of the school year. He's like, you know, something you're interested in? And I'm like, yeah, totally, because I might not have a job in 3 months if this place gets sold. So he set me up with an interview with Sensophonics, and you know, I took the interview, actually, you know, ended up getting the job. So I worked there on staff, you know, full time for almost 3 years, while running the studio. It was, you know, just a really great experience. And I'm still doing consulting work with them, even though I'm not officially a staff member anymore. But through that, I was able to, you know, increase my income. I met some more people. I was able to start gathering, you know, private funding, people who were willing to like give me just personal loans to help keep the studio open. And after about 6 months, they dropped the price of our building, and the combination of the extra income from the outside job and some loans I was able to pull together from people, I was able to buy our building. So, you know, we were almost gone, you know, multiple times, but like, I just kept at it. You know, like, I don't want to let this go.
What year did you buy the building?
2012.
That's not cheap buying a building in Chicago.
No, no. And, you know, but the thing is, the guy that owned the building before us was just a really, really great guy. He was always helping us out. Like when we were first starting out, like, you know, it's like, oh, we're a little short on rent this month. And he's like, it's cool. Like, you know, we'll, it'll work out somewhere down the road. And he, you know, help us out with that. And, you know, he just gave, he really wanted the building to go to us. He didn't want it to get demolished. You know, he built the space, and, you know, he ran, actually, before he built the studio, it was a jazz club. He ran this place called the Lunar Cabaret. And so like our control room is actually built on the stage of this club. And so there's just like this long history here of art and music. And, you know, he didn't want to see that get destroyed. So he, it was just, you know, he wasn't in it, you know, as a, you know, commercial interest. Like most people, most building owners would have been like, I'm going to just sell it to the, you know, highest bidding developer and walk away from it. He's like, yeah, I might take, I'll take a little bit less for it because I want to see this continue.
How did you put all the systems in place and the protocol there at Mystery Street in order to, you know, handle all of these very related, but very different tasks?
We have a pretty, you know, intensive employee manual of like, here's what everybody's job is. And, you know, we make sure, you know, everyone's kind of really trained on things. We train people for a long time when people come on staff here. I mean, I would say it takes people, you know, at least a year to really know everything that we do here. You know, we'll start off with like, hey, this is your job. But like, you really have to know everything because, you know, from one day to the next, you never know what kind of phone call you're going to get. And we don't, you know, we don't staff, you know, 10 people at a time here. It's usually one or two people working at a time. And someone might call up and say, you know, I need this done today. And if the person who's working that day doesn't know how to do it, then, you know, we don't get that business. So, and we'd really just try to make sure everyone, you know, is caught up to speed. We have, you know, we have a lot of meetings, and you know, we try to keep everybody trained and everything, but also just making sure we hire capable people. You know, our engineers here are great, you know, really brilliant people. And, you know, I'm really fortunate for that. You know, I have people I can trust around me.
That's great. Yeah. Hire well. Mm-hmm. Hire well. That's, I think not everybody always gets that. What is your personal approach to and philosophy with how to combine the love of recording and business? How do you marry those two and be successful with it? What's any general overarching philosophies?
Yeah. I mean, that's a tough one because, you know, a lot of times those are conflicting because like I still to this day, I'll feel bad for charging someone for what I do, even though I know I'm giving them a great product. But I'm like, I love this so much. Like, how can I even charge somebody for it? Like, I just want to do it. But, you know, the other side of the coin is that, you know, more than half of my time is spent doing administrative work as the owner of the company. You know, I'm operating the business. I've got to keep that going in order to make sure that, you know, employees here can continue to have their jobs and just so we can stay open. You know, I had to relearn that really and just understand how, you know, how to manage money and, you know, how to manage our resources here in order to just to stay in business. And it's a tough thing. So, you know, it's a balancing act. And, you know, the other thing is I've got two small kids, so I'm always balancing family on top of that. So, you know, we've got a 3.5-year-old and a 1.5-year-old. So they're running around my house like crazy all the time. So
that's a great transition. Yeah. I was going to ask you, how do you manage the work-life balance thing?
Yeah. I mean, I've kind of had to move out of doing a lot of the night work and move to stuff during the day just because the kids, it's like, you know, basically between, you know, 4 p.m. and 9 p.m. it's kid time. It's, you know, it's dinner and it's putting kids to bed. And that's our prime time in the studio. Like, that's our busiest time. I've had to move into doing more of the stuff during the day, you know, acting as the president of the company, you know, making the phone calls and, you know, doing quality control checks on our archival work. But that's one of those things that has been really great for the studio, is being able to, you know, think a little bit bigger and go, well, do I want to work every night and every weekend forever? Or are there other things we can do that don't require, you know, that doesn't require everybody to work in the evening? And, you know, you can have a night off or, you know, weekend off. You know, that was hard to get to that point. You know, I'm happy to say that we're there now. And, you know, I couldn't imagine going back to how it was early, you know, when it's just, you know, you have to work every single night to stay open. And during the day, it's like you're working, you know, a day job too, just to, you know, pay the bills.
I know you have your hands full with the family you have, and I know that challenge of two kids. You have your hands full with that, but you also have your hands full with this definitely a growing business. When you can find the time, what are the things that you do to continue to educate yourself, to continue to motivate yourself, and the things that you do where you get your Joe time?
Sleep when I can. Rest, that's important. You know, I just recently got a gym membership for the first time in, you know, 4 years. So that's making me feel good. You know, just, you know, time to think, you know, that's the thing. It's like, I'm always like, I have 1,000 interruptions all day long. You know, I was just trying to have a conversation earlier with someone here, and, you know, my phone rang 4 times, 2 people walked in the door. And I've got my son there sitting in, you know, in the control room, you know, drawing and stuff. So I'm like, you know, I've been pulling 30 places at once, you know, all the time. So having, you know, just an opportunity to go, hey, I'm going to take, you know, take a half hour and like run or go skateboarding or, you know, do some bird watching, you know, it's like really nice. but I, you know, I just feel like I'm, you know, if I'm, I get a, I, know, I feel like I accomplish a lot actually when I'm just, you know, have time to think. And that's when I can plan and, you know, decide on, you know, where we're going to go next.
There's so much to this business that I'm fascinated by. If I'm ever in Chicago, I will most definitely come by to see this in action. For the listener, once again, it's mysterystreetrecording.com. Fascinating business you have here, Joe. Really, really interesting.
Thank you.
Look them up. Check it out. Lots to learn. All right, Joe, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Get some sleep.
Thanks. See you later. Bye.
All right, take care. Joe Tissone here on the Working Class Audio Podcast. Thanks for being with me today. If you can, stop by our sponsors' websites. They really help make the Working Class Audio Podcast possible. I'm talking about The License Lab, Roswell Pro Audio, Audio Technica, Gearsluts.com, and Universal Audio. Yeah, pay them a visit. And we want to thank Mr. Cliff Truesdell and Mr. Chuck Smith for their efforts on the show. And I want to thank you for coming here week after week to listen to me ramble. Spread the word, visit us on social media, and stop by workingclassaudio.com. And until next time, my friends, take care. Hey, I know many of you are aware of this, but for those of you that aren't aware, Working Class Audio sponsors the forum over at gearspace.com called Audio Life. And quite simply put, it's a place where audio professionals can go to talk with other audio professionals about things other than audio gear, including life hacks, work-life balance, health and hearing loss. You know, if you want to talk with other audio professionals who can identify with what your lifestyle is like and how it relates to things going on in the world outside of audio, this is a great place to go and check out. So head on over to gearspace.com, check out Audio Life, many of the same topics that we discuss here on the show on gearspace.com. So check that out.